Welcome to Crossing the Divide, part of a grassroots multimedia collaboration between Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel, dedicated to highlighting the issues impacting daily life on Colorado's western slope. Through film screenings, community discussions, and this very podcast, the goal of the Crossing the Divide project is to cultivate the trust and shared purpose that enable citizens to transcend divides and work together toward effective solutions for the challenges we face. Our inaugural discussion looks at the effectiveness of social media in building social movements and affecting social change, and how this could impact the burgeoning #MeToo movement sweeping the nation, shedding light on the problem of sexual assault and harassment in the workplace and beyond. I'm Gretchen Reist, your guide over the divide and into the diverse terrain of Western Colorado. Joining us today to explore the efficacy of using social media as a conduit for activism is Elaine Venter, instructor of mass communication at CMU, specializing in new media with an emphasis on social media, gaming, and internet media accessibility. She is currently pursuing a PhD in cultural studies from Claremont Graduate University, writing her dissertation on the political, economic, and cultural impact of geo-blocking online media content. Our conversation is based largely on the work of Molly Crockett, assistant professor of psychology at Yale University, noted for her work on human morality, altruism, and decision-making. Her presentation, Moral Outrage in the Digital Age, explores punishment behavior on social media platforms and can be accessed on YouTube. So in looking at social media, in evolutionary terms, obviously, this is something that's brand new. And so researchers are trying to play catch up with how this is affecting us as human beings, how we interact with each other, and why. And so recently, a number of neuroscientists have started to research online behavior. And they are looking at the motives of why we choose to express moral outrage in online forums, but also the impact that doing so has on our ability to turn that anger or disgust into real-world action. Now, based on this research, there have been a number of articles that have come out, and one of which that I read claimed that the #MeToo movement exemplifies what's wrong with social media. Now, this is an article that was written a number of weeks ago, and as we know, with social media, things move very quickly now. But the point is that when we are constantly bombarded with what we see as bad behavior or immoral acts, we will begin to experience escalating states of rage. But because of what's happening, likely on a neurochemical level, we will eventually exhaust ourselves to the point where we actually can't meaningfully act beyond writing another comment. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
So I have a lot of thoughts about this, and I'll try and hit them in subject matter. So the first one I'll hit is the aspect of that idea of social media is new. And actually, evolutionarily speaking, it's not new. Social media is very old. We could argue that the internet itself kind of sprung about from a social aspect, from ARPANET developing network to communicate with one another. What is that except not social communication? Perhaps the reasoning was not like Instagram in your food picture, your latest lunch, whatever it may be. It moved on from there. We then had the development of discussion forums. And that, for me, the way I see it, was the beginning really of social media. They were not the kind of frameworks we have now. We tend to think of things like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as the structures in which we look at social media. But discussion forums were nothing but social media. I remember as a kid in South Africa, we got the internet at my house a little bit later. I was about maybe 9 or 10 when we got our first real computer that we could log on to. And we paid by the hour over there at that time. And so every kid only got so much time. But we found this site, Chattropolis, and it's totally different from what it was to then. If you go to the sites now, they change, so it's not the same. But it was a discussion forum where people from across the world could log in, and we talked to people all over, and we made lies. There were people who asked us if we had pet rhinos or things like that, and we did. We said we had a pet rhino, Daisy. We did not. But there was something that was fun in that little bit of a white lie. There were a lot of truths, but a lot of white lies. And our parents, they were kind of aware that we were on the site. They were careful. But as therapists, they were like, this is good. This is socialization with people that you don't get to meet at school or things like that. And that's, for me, I've always thought of discussion forums and forum boards and whatever we want to call them as the first real social media. And then we evolved more to things like Facebook, which once it now become the structured network of you must see your friends, you must be able to share within the system.
Let me ask you really quick. Yeah. Do you consider yourself an extrovert or an introvert?
Oh, I'm quite extroverted. Yes, I'm sure my students would agree that I'm oh so quite shy. No, I'm not too shy, but as I've grown older, I've fallen more into a middle line between the two. I'm careful online. I'm almost pretty much an open book online for some things, but I do have certain accounts that exist that are purely for me to escape, which is my introverted kind of self that happens there. But that's why for me to go online and to be open about some things and talk and things like that was a little bit easier. But my sister, who is an introvert, and we'll say that she identifies as such, also actually found an escape, if you will. Not complete escapism, but a way for her to meet people in a way that was more comfortable.
The only reason I interject that is because, I'm taking this information from a great book I would highly recommend called The Organized Mind. And he goes into how oftentimes somewhat introverted, maybe even antisocial people will gravitate toward this type of outlet. And consciously, they feel like they have human contact because it's easier for them to do that.
Yes.
But when in reality, it's not exactly the same.
Isn't it? I have another great book too, Sherry Turkle. She actually has, it's a trilogy, if you will. And it starts from the 1980s. She's a psychoanalyst and a computer scientist. And she looks at relationships online from 1980s and evolving onwards. And the first one is, I believe it's Life on the Screen. And then the latest one was Alone Together. And her opinion changes. I think she'd fall more into what you would think in the beginning, very positive, saying that it's a great place for people to get to know others and the relationships are real and no problems. And then she gets into the darker side in terms of, well, what about catfishing? People who lie. And she writes the story about this one man who portrayed himself as a woman to other people in this group that were also women and started a lesbian relationship with another woman. And they clicked online, but when he finally came out that he's actually a man, there was all this drama in the group, and the woman that was the partner really couldn't decide what was real or not in that relationship, and so decided to break it off. And all of these aspects in there. I feel like it's very much real and justified to have relationships online. I've had friends who met each other online and are married. But there are also horror stories of the fact of some people who use it more of a escape to a complete alternate personality, which there are concerns there in terms that it depends. How are they affecting others? And that's the big question. Do we cognizantly think about how what we're writing, how what we're sharing is affecting others online?
And his argument would be no. Mm-hmm. His argument is that our impression is that we are interacting socially much more, when in actuality, what we're really doing, because of the way social media works, where we're probably at home, sitting in front of a computer, phone, that we're actually acting in isolation. So we're becoming increasingly isolated, but getting the feeling of actually being more social, mm-hmm, and being more connected. But what the research shows now with iGen, which, yeah, is the generation coming up, which has always been attached to this, is that college students in particular who spend a large portion of their time online in studies exhibit less ability and less desire to show empathy.
Mm.
Which is interesting.
It is interesting, but I think that's the big key because, and you actually lock on to back again to the Me Too movement in terms of why Tarana Burke started the movement to begin with. And I'll get to that in a moment, because one of the things I want to then connect is going on from the evolution aspect now to that, the outrage aspect, is exactly this idea of, because we feel, And it's true, some people do not necessarily feel that deep connection with others online. And it really depends. Myself, I was raised in an environment where my parents had always made me cognizant of my relationship to others, whether online or not. And they were always worried about online too. When I met my first friends from in real life to online, my mother was very, very concerned, but she had seen how we had communicated with each other to begin with, and we made it very safe. It was at a geek convention. There are some people who they weren't necessarily raised in that kind of a communication environment. Communication does not come natural to everyone. It's a learned behavior for the most part. And it depends on the kind of familial relationships you have and the kind of guardians that you have, teachers that you've had, all those leading figures around you who have told you what communication is, how it works, and how it doesn't work. And some people are just better at it than others, and that depends. And so if you already don't have empathy in real life, that really translates online. And we see that. And this idea, though, and we see that for the I generation who have been raised purely, because I remember a time with no internet in my life.
Oh, I go back even farther.
You go but I have students now who they don't know what life was before disconnected. And I can't say that they're not empathetic. It could be, though, that those students have been raised with deep familial connections. But there are definitely those who there's already a lack of empathy then in real life. And so more so online. And if you already start with that unconnected, then it's never going to translate to build the empathy. And that's what Tarana Burke, who also falls in line with the generation of before online, started it. And I actually have here something from the statement of what she started for. First of all, empowerment through empathy, especially among women of color. That was the main focus, to build empathy again for those marginalized communities and groups. And we'll come back to that later again. The key point, though, is that she wanted to bring in empathy, which means that she saw a lack. And we hear a lot of groups online, the groups that I am now with, especially teacher groups, we talk about how do we put empathy in technology? Is it that technology makes us empathetic or not? Or is it in us? And then how do we use the technology then to translate empathy or to present that? And I think for the Me Too movement, in terms of the study stating, it could very well have been the problem in that it wasn't empathetic and that all that it was shallow outrage. And that's that connection, that idea of we feel like we're communicating, but it's really shallow connection. In terms of teaching interpersonal relationships, there's a difference between deep connections and more shallow connections. For example, my connection with one neighbor to the next might be very different. I don't know one of my neighbors, the other neighbor I see every now and again. So we have a much closer, deeper connection. That translates online too. If you're talking to someone for the first time, just commenting on there's not going to be a deep connection. And that might affect your empathetic reaction, if you will, versus if you're perhaps having a discussion with your mom on Facebook, or a family member or a friend you've known for years. Maybe that empathy level is going to be different. And I feel like maybe this research, because it's such a big movement, as soon as movements get big, it's that question of where's the empathy then in the bigger picture?
Again, coming back to some of these studies, we tend to, things that we experience online, we see online, any act of bad behavior, immoral act, we will have a stronger anger reaction to those things than if the event occurred right in front of us.
Mm. And the really good example of this is people who take videos of people who have been doing not even necessarily illegal things, but just things that might be seen as societally not acceptable. Maybe the more rougher examples are those people who are inciting racial slurs to others. There was one on a metro. I don't know if it was San Francisco, New York, but it was there. And someone was busy taking the video, but this guy was just, railing at this, I believe it was Asian American. Quite remember. Point is, not white or not perceived as white. And the man who was doing this was an older, white perceived gentleman, Caucasian gentleman. And, it took a long time. I think that video went on for a good minute, 30 seconds, before somebody finally said something. As soon as that video was online, there were tweets immediately. And it was funny because I actually saw some people who wrote, like, how many of you would actually have stood up immediately right away. There have been examples of videos in China, especially, of people getting hurt or something happening and people pulling out their phones and they're recording the event, but nobody's actually helping. There have been incidences of women being attacked and things like that. Videos recorded and somebody posts and says, oh my gosh, isn't this horrible? I'm like, okay, why are you posting it video-wise? Why didn't you do something there? But is this idea of, oh, I recorded it and I'm posting it, right? Versus doing something at the time of the actual event or saying something, because it feels so much safer to do it online. Then, for example, if you were to say something, very well, those people might start attacking you. Or those people might start saying things to you. Then you get put into that position. And I think, I'd hate to say it, but there have been situations where I've been in where I probably should have stood up. And it was really, as much as extroverted as I am, just because you're extroverted doesn't mean that you are comfortable with
confrontation.
Yes, thank you, confrontation or an argument that might be happening. You know, so especially things, whether it's in your family or friend's life, I think most of us can say we've had examples of this where we knew we should have said something, but we went and tweeted about it instead later. That's something that I'm consciously working on now, continuously trying to improve on that. And it's not easy.
No, because there's far less risk. And I think that's why we are much quicker to jump onto social media and comment or share or post, because we recognize that there is less risk there than if we were actually in that situation where, let's face it, somebody could pull a gun, someone could attack you, or this is someone you might know, and you know, there's just that whole discomfort of confrontation, which maybe we could argue, and we don't have to get into it, you know, the less connected we are from one another, the less likely we might be to do that, because we're already starting from a place of face-to-face contact is a little uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't see that with our generation as much, although I do see that developing, where you go into an airport or anywhere where people have to wait and all you see are people with their faces and their phones.
I think it's so interesting you bring that up, though, because in response to that argument, there are people who have been posting the picture of, which has gone viral, people on a train from pre-even cell phones with newspapers. And they're reading newspapers. But I would actually argue that, it depends what you're doing with your phone, if you're on social media or whether you're reading something. But for me, sometimes I'm actually in an airport. I'm on my phone and I'm on Twitter, but I'm talking to my friends on a group thing. I consider that socialization, but that's because I'm actually talking to people I've now known in real life for very long. I met them online first. Now I know them in real life. And so our connection is much deeper. And it's just more comfortable to socialize with someone that I know than it is to try and make that awkward eye contact with someone and then feel like, oh, now I have to say something. Oh, you know, you've had that. You look someone in the eye like, oh no. But we all also have that one person who then talks too much. You know, they make eye contact with you, and the next thing you know their entire life story, which sometimes is fantastic, but there are days, especially airport travel, especially if you're doing a long trip, it's just a matter of, I don't want to speak with you right now. And that comes off as rude, which is interesting, because I think we should all be allowed our moments of, I need my space.
Space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is where I think the phone, pulling that out and being on there is like, yeah, thank you.
Is the space.
Yes.
And I say that as somebody who is generally one of those people, please don't talk to me. You know, I'm more of an introvert that way. So absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Getting back to this idea of moral outrage before we move on to more specifically talking about the hashtag MeToo movement, why would we express moral outrage and why would we exhibit punishment behavior?
Mm.
And when we go back to our tribal instincts, it was to promote cooperation within the group.
Mm-hmm.
So if you speak up and single somebody out as doing something that is perceived as not being to the benefit of the group or somehow being detrimental, you would stop that behavior and you would have greater group cooperation. So social media plays on that. That's why we're drawn to it, partially, right?
Mm.
Because it's helping us exercise maybe that part of ourselves. If we're really, really angry that somebody has done something wrong, it can be an act of vengeance.
Right.
You did this, I'm going to post this. And this has actually happened, very well documented, that people will lose their jobs,
yes,
you know, because these things go viral, get out. So it can, in certain circumstances, actually bring some type of harm to a wrongdoer. And then there's also deterrence, which comes back to that idea of we want to change the behavior. But if I'm just an average, non-celebrity, average user who maybe is not even all that well-versed in how to use social media, you know, what are the chances that anything I write is ever going to get to that person who's done that wrong, especially if it is somebody who's famous or, you know, whatnot? The question becomes, if we don't believe that we're actively going to change someone's behavior, why do we keep doing this? Why are we still drawn into expressing this kind of moral outrage? And the research shows, and again, this is another neurochemical thing, right? Mm-hmm. The dopamine response is that it just feels good.
Yeah.
It feels like we've done something and we get a dopamine rush from it. And so that's why we maybe continue to engage in this behavior, maybe more than we should.
Yeah.
And that kind of brings us to this idea of public shaming, which has been talked about a lot recently and we see happening more often. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about public shaming.
I think we can all argue that many of the things we see online on social media, they existed before. What we're seeing, though, with social media is that it's at a much more intensified form or rate.
And mass scale.
Mass scale. The speed and the mass scale are just, it's almost inconceivable. But it's very much the reality that we're in. And you present a lot of those cases of people who have gotten fired for posting things that were considered racially insensitive or things like that. And there's, especially in the US, that's very difficult because we claim freedom of expression. But what happens when that expression is not deemed socially acceptable? There are two kind of different acceptance there. One is the legal and one is a social kind of acceptance. And so we have, you know, if there's a legal loophole that, well, this person has said something, but it's not actually a threat. It doesn't actually fall under that legal realm where they can be punished for a crime. What can I do then? And so it was this idea of, well, we have another recourse of action, which is to publicly shame them. And that's why we see people then, you know, linking to people's workplaces, sending, hey, do you know that your employee has these thoughts? And it's interesting because before, when you were hired at a job, it would be this, you had a separation of work life and private life. That's what it was. What you did in your private life was your private life. I remember when people still said that, hey, what you do in your private time, that's all your business. But when you come to work, this is who you are. This is what you do. This is what we stand for. And I feel like today that's no longer really the idea, especially because of social media. And this idea then of you are who you work for and everything else. So everything with your social media is connected with that. For journalists, for some, that is now the case, where some of the places have stated, if you have a Facebook page, you're a journalist. There's no longer a distinction between private and public there. It's not all of them yet. In LA, there have been some pushbacks against that. But I can't remember, I believe it was the New York Times who posted this as part of their social media guidelines as a pushback towards the fake news and trying to mitigate the existence of journalists online now with their journalist persona and their private. And they don't get that anymore. But what happens if you're just someone who works at an Abercrombie & Fitch? And you don't even post it on your social media. You don't say, I work at Abercrombie & Fitch. You make no indication of that. And even your tweets are pretty vague about the place that you work. But you post a bunch of racial slurs. And this is actually a case that it would happen. And then that gets caught. And people then dox you, which is to say that they find your personal information and work, workplace, all of it, and then send it to that. And the workplace, what does Abercrombie & Fitch do? They are now caught in the middle of this thing. And I understand for business, that's a very difficult place to be. This isn't even an executive. We're talking about someone who just folds a client. It's not to say that the job isn't important. It is. But it's that idea of the hierarchy in the place. It's like, this isn't even an executive we're having to deal with now. This is what workplaces have to kind of do. And the safest thing would be, I believe that person got fired. There's been the instance of the PR professional. This one was pretty famous, who posted a really poor HIV/AIDS joke before she flew back to South Africa. We make jokes in private that we all know are really borderline. We shouldn't do it, right? There are people do it. Maybe not all, but there are some people who do it. But you keep that private because you know, wow, socially, if I say this out loud, it's totally unacceptable. It's not funny. It's not good. I can only say it to this one friend or two. And we know that it's bad, but we do it. But now, so that PR professional thought that her social media space was this place where she could post this, which was a really poor joke. HIV/AIDS is very serious in South Africa. I think 1 in 4 now at this point contracted, and it's an incredibly huge deal. But it's one of those things where you just don't say that out loud. You just don't. And she said it out loud in what she thought was her private space. And the problem was one of the followers picked it up, didn't like it, retweeted it. And that's one of the things, too, in terms of your outrage. Some people's outrage gets viral and some people's don't. And right. I think it all is based on, A, is your account private? That's never usually just a safe bet, because if someone follows you on your private account and they print screen, take a screenshot of that tweet or that Facebook post, it can still go out. But the most part, I found that if you're private, those thoughts typically stay with whoever is following you, which might just be a small group of friends for some people. But if you're public, if you use hashtags, or if one of your followers is really keen on a type of issue or things like that, those are the kinds of things that are going to help that post possibly get viral. Those are the things that people have to watch out for. And that's why, especially for my students and lots of college-age students, they don't realize what their pages look like. There are many who have, you just look up their name and you see it. And it's this idea of businesses now look at that because they know now that this is an issue they have to deal with. Any person that they might be hiring, people are going to look at their social media. Now, legally, they're not supposed to hire you based on social media. It happens in any case, because it's one of these issues that they want to mitigate. They want to avoid. They want to say, oh, this is this person's social media and it's public. If we hire them and somebody sees it and they decide to have an outrager, if you will, we're going to be caught in the middle of that. That's a difficult thing for me, because I feel like some of those people, yeah, you fall on a moral gray line where you deserve some sort of retribution. We can't do it legally. I do not think doxing is in any way, shape, or good form. Or the other term for in the gaming community especially, we have swatting, where you get the SWAT team. You call in a fake call to the SWAT team. We had a very unfortunate, very sad story just over the holidays, where an innocent man was caught in the middle of a swatting situation. Two gamers who had an argument with each other over a betting game on Call of Duty, and the one gave a fake address to the other one, and he decided to go ahead and get him swatted. And it turns out the police force that happened to go out that night were a little charged up, and you know, the man died. An innocent man who didn't even know
who these people were.
Yeah, the family didn't even know what swatting was. And that's one of the dangers of that social media aspect of that outrage. There was an outrage between those two, and they took it to a whole new level.
Wow.
And that's some of the concerns that we have to take in it. But there's some outrage, like this Me Too movement, that I feel this is something that shouldn't be ignored, and we should allow it. Because I hear people say, well, we should just get rid of social media if people are no longer going to be allowed to express what they want, or if your private life is no longer private. And I feel like I cannot justify that, because as soon as you shut it down, it means shutting down all the good things too.
Yeah, and that should be a matter of personal choice.
Right?
Really. You can choose not to be on there. If that's a concern of yours, or you feel a certain way, then just... And people do that.
Yeah, people do that. There are people who log off, who keep out, or there are people who will post in support of those other people. Say, look, I don't like what this person did, but I don't feel like they deserve to get fired. What makes that moral outrage justifiable versus not? Because we all have different moral values. It's, you know, in different countries, we have different values and ethics about different things. So what makes one right versus the other? That, you know, and that for me is the complication in moral outrage that we have to be really careful about.
And the other part of that, which I'll get into here, and then we'll transition into looking more specifically at hashtag Me Too. We know from what we've talked about that expression of outrage does give us that dopamine shot. It feels good to do it. But there is another reason behind why we do it. And that is a more, I'll say, less altruistic reason.
Yeah.
Which is, even if what I say is not going to have any effect on the situation, in doing so, I signal my own virtue to this larger group. And it's a way of protecting my own reputation.
Right.
I am telling people, I do not believe in this. This goes against my morality. In those terms, it becomes more about the self, really, than even the cause. And so that leads to a lot of questions, which we'll get into, which is, we see all this outrage. How much is that an overestimation, maybe, of how passionate people really are about a particular issue, when oftentimes it has more to do with that individual wanting to say something about who they are,
yeah,
rather than make some kind of social change. And I'm going to move into a quote from Molly Crockett, because I think it's very telling, and it's one of these things where overall social media can be a positive force, but we have to study the implications and ramifications as time goes on, and we see how we're utilizing it in different ways. We always have to come back to that to sort of analyze what's going on and what do we need to change, if anything. And I'll end with this quote from her, which is lengthy. And she says, quote, "All of this research suggests that people punish unfairness primarily because it's satisfying. But the story they tell themselves and others is that they punish for moral reasons. This is something we need to pay attention to, because punishment is very easily moralized in situations that trigger these appetites for destruction. So punishment of outgroups can be reframed as a concern for safety. Punishment of inequality can be justified as a fight for economic justice. And this research suggests that in some cases, moral goals can be a post hoc rationalization designed to make destructive behavior more socially acceptable."
Thanks for tuning in to our first podcast episode of Crossing the Divide. Join me next time as my conversation with Elaine Venter turns its focus to the history of the hashtag MeToo movement, from its inception with founder Tarana Burke to a snowballing effort buoyed by social media outrage that shows no sign of slowing down. We'll explore how social media can continue to keep the scourge of sexual harassment in the spotlight, and how it can be utilized to affect measurable societal change. Remember to follow Crossing the Divide on Facebook to keep apprised of new releases and other local events highlighting issues impacting life on Colorado's western slope.